It's time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for April 9th, 2022. Spring has really sprung here in Northeast Ohio, even though the weather is still inconsistent. We are about to head into the 60s and even 70s next week, and I, for one, welcome it with open arms. This week's show is a twofer, and I think both guests are well worth the listen. First, I want to introduce you to someone I believe embodies what it means to be your own person. From her first bike trip with a friend while she was in college to a year-long trip overseas by bike, and then owning one of the most iconic bike shops in the U.S., Estelle Gray has a life story that should just maybe be made into a movie. Today, she's retired. Well, she's retired from a professional life, but still working, making flags to raise money for the Ukraine war effort, and supporting the people in Ukraine who work for her software company. I've been acquainted with Estelle for many years, but it was this conversation where I really got to know her. After we speak with Estelle, I welcome one of my favorite people back to the show. John Sirico has his finger on the pulse of cities, living and working in the Big Apple and taking on a slew of topics that are both interesting and pertinent to urban living, which always includes bikes. I used to cross paths with Estelle Gray at the bicycle trade shows. She was the owner of R&E Cycles in Seattle at the time, and her story of how she became that owner is only part of our conversation today.
Hi, Estelle. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest this week. It's good to see you.
My pleasure.
I have not seen you in many, many years. We used to sort of cross paths at the trade shows, but those are no more. And another woman veteran of the bike industry, I thought it would be an interesting conversation. And I'd like to know what you're doing now. I know some of what you're doing right now, and we will talk about that toward the end of the show. We seem to have a shared sort of background with this horrible thing that's going on in Europe. And we'll see what else comes up. Tell me a little bit about your background. I really don't know much about it.
Well, in college, my freshman year of college, I made this friend, and she was really into cycling. And I knew nothing about bicycles. This was like in early 70s. And she, after freshman year was finishing up, she said, "Hey, get a bike and let's go take a bike tour." And I was like, "What's that?" So we went out and I bought a bike and I bought panniers. And at that time we weren't camping. She said, "Let's go up to Nova Scotia, Canada for 6 weeks." And I'm like, "Oh, where's that?" So we got ourselves up there and I got a nice pair of red little gym shorts that I wore and a nice new sneakers and brought some nice clothes for in case we went out at night. And we went up and spent about 6 weeks cycling around Cape Breton Island in Nova Scotia. Little did I know how huge some of those grades were and how steep things were. And at that point, you know, I didn't have any low gears or anything, but we just had a blast. And from that year on, almost every year of my life, not every, but almost everyone, I've taken at least a month cycling tour and sometimes longer.
Can I ask a question about the bike you were riding then?
The Peugeot U08. And
it had aluminum
wheels with quick release. Oh boy. I paid $130 for it. My mom could not believe I was going to spend that much money on a bicycle.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Jersey till I was 18.
I could tell you were an East Coast girl.
And then I've been around for a while. I've been on the West Coast quite a bit. So then I finished college and I said, "Well, you know, I don't really know what I want to do. I'll take a really big bicycle trip." So then I bought a tent and a sleeping bag and I took my bicycle and went to Europe for a year. And then I came back to Madison, Wisconsin, where I was in school, and really didn't know what I wanted to do. And a friend of mine was living for free in Seattle, a house sitting a house for a year or something. He said, hey, come on out, stay for free in Seattle. I'm like, oh, I know where that is. So I packed up my bicycle and a few other things and went to Seattle. And the first day I went looking for a job, I thought, well, you know, I think I know how to put a bicycle together. I've worked on my bike a fair amount. And I had painted it after my Europe trip. I took it apart and I took everything out, fixed cup and everything. I got it. Somebody must have taken the fixed cup out for me. And I hung it from the tree and spray painted it, put it all back together. So I thought, you know, I could probably assemble bikes while I look for a real job. And I walked into Arnie Cycles and there was this guy in the back picking spokes up off the floor. They'd obviously brought the box or two of spokes. I said, hey, and he goes, what do you need? And I said, I'm looking for a job. And he goes, we don't need anybody. And I said, oh, that's too bad. You don't know what you're missing. I don't know. Because I thought, so the shop was really, really upscale for a bike shop. It was really small. And it had like a little red carpet. And you walked in and custom bikes hanging and Campion Dura-Ace. And that was not my style. So I thought, you know, I'm out of here. And the guy got up and goes, what do you mean? What am I missing? And we chit-chatted for a little bit, and he took my phone number. And the next day, he called me and said, hey, let's meet for breakfast. And they hired me as a frame builder at Arnie Cycles, Rodriguez and Erickson. I knew nothing. And so Glenn took me under his wing and taught me the basics of frame building. It wasn't natural for me. I didn't grow up with tools. You know how some people have like really nice tools and they've got pegboard and they're outlined and they know all their tools. That's what my dad had with all five of his tools. So they hired me in the frame shop. And I remember pretty on in the first week or two, they called me to help upstairs because it was kind of busy and I really enjoyed it. And then like the next day, Angel and Glenn must have been gone. And it was a beautiful day. And the guys who were like, three or four other men working there at the time. And they said, hey, we're going to go for a bike ride. And they put a sign on the door saying shop closed for an hour too. And I said, didn't you tell that guy he could pick his bike up today around noon? You know, it was kind of custom wheels. And they're like, he'll come back. And I was like, boy, that's not very good customer service. And they started calling me up to help on the floor when it got busy. And I really, really liked working on the floor and I didn't like the frame shop. And there was a guy on the floor who didn't like the floor and he was really good at the frame shop. So we flipped. And then about 2 weeks later, the owner, Angel Rodriguez, called me up to his office and said, what do you do around here? And I thought, I can't believe I'm going to get fired. I work so hard and I'm really good on the floor. And he goes, well, I want to make you the manager. I'm like, what? And he goes, I thought you'd kind of organize this a little better and like control those boys. And I said, okay. And then he left. That was in probably March. And then he left in like April for a 6-month tour. I don't remember where he went and left me in charge of the store. And the rest is history. And even though those four guys didn't have great customer service skills, they got better. And I remember one time this guy called up and he said, I answered the phone and he said, I need to talk to one of the men. I said, well, I can try to help. He goes, I have a technical question. I need one man. I said, okay. So I put him on hold and I said, hey, Chris, this guy wants to know, blah, blah, blah. And Chris says, okay, here's the answer. I said, okay. And then Chris gets on the phone. He says, hey, how can I help you? And the guy asked the question. And Chris says, geez, I don't know the answer to that. Let me get you somebody that can. So I answered the gentleman's question. That was pretty
fun. A great story. I love it. What a perfect way to mess with some guy's ego and testosterone. Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. Oh my God, that is such a great story. We're speaking with Estelle Gray. She's up in Seattle. You're still there?
Actually, I'm in Medford, Oregon.
Oh, it's so pretty up in Oregon.
It is.
I like it up there. And we're talking about the old days and we are going back some R&E cycles. If you don't know anything about it, and I'm just going to say this to Estelle. She doesn't know. We ride a Bushnell, one of the last ones he built before he left, Mr. Bushnell, that my husband Brian designed. It's a Bushnell tandem, one of the ugliest colors ever. We let him choose the color, but I love it. And it just went to Belinky for couplers. We weren't going to do it, and we finally decided to do it. So we're waiting for it to come back. I can't wait to get back on the bike. Okay, moving right along. So you were the manager. Angel took off for 6 months, which sounds just like him. And what happened after that?
I worked at the store and we grew it and grew it and then we shrunk it. And Angel sold it. I can't remember when. And the sale didn't go well. And I promised Angel I would stay for a year because he hadn't been like paid and he wanted to make sure that everything worked okay in the shop. So I promised Angel I would stay a year and I stayed 364 days. And on the 365th day, I gave notice. And the next day, I don't know who passed the word around, but the next day I got called by Suntour and they asked me if I wanted to work with them. So I worked with them for about maybe 6 months. And I knew things were not going well at the business. I knew. And I kept calling Angel and telling him. And finally, very quickly, it went under. And Angel said, how about you run it now? You know, I'll sell it to you. So Angel sold it to me. And I stayed there until about 2004-ish.
Wow, that's longer than I thought you were there, actually.
And then I've always had a second career in me. I've always been attracted to the underdog kids. And so I got a special ed teaching certificate and I taught for almost 20 years.
Wow. And now you're retired, allegedly?
I retired completely.
Allegedly.
Completely.
Retirement looks so different for us, I think.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about a couple of things. You know, Ed Benjamin reminded me that I really needed to contact you. And so I did immediately after talking with him. And he said that you and Sally have like a stable of e-bikes.
Well, I wouldn't call it a stable, but we each have three. When they add up in the garage, there's six of them now, so it does look like a stable. But we each have a commuter, a road bike, and a mountain bike. E-bike.
And so do you use those instead of other transportation?
Yes.
You do. Do you have a car?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. It's out there somewhere.
I was very lucky. Both careers that I did, I commuted by bike. And the reason I went for the e-bike finally is I'll go back to the bike shop days. We would support our shop, would support a lot of the really big rides, you know, the Seattle to Portland, the Chili Hilly, and Dan Toll, who I took on as a business partner when I took the shop. He had a Doberman Pinscher and we would take a trailer and fill it with wheels and tools and things. And that darn Doberman Pinscher too. And we would pull that thing everywhere on a tandem. And then I got a dog and then I started hauling my dog to work and he was an 80 pound Samoyed. And in Seattle, that's not easy with all those hills. I got really strong. And then let's think, I moved to California and started teaching. And then I had a different dog and I pulled that dog 21 miles each way commuting. And then I lost that dog and I got another dog. I got a true honest to goodness service dog, a 60 pound black lab. And I got him for my classroom for my students. So that was only a 12 mile commute. But I just was like, you know, 60 years old and enough is enough. And I got an e-bike to haul him with. And then the rest is history. I got hooked. And now where we live, I have to go up a 16% grade, two blocks to get up to where we live. We live kind of on the base of a mountain. So I'm really glad to have an e-bike.
So it's interesting you say that, that I hear so many people our age, and we're about the same age, I think, who are not being freaked out by wanting and needing an e-bike. And yet there's this sort of sliver of the industry that's saying, oh no, I'll never have an e-bike. When you ride, do you get the same experience? I have not ridden one. I have to be honest. And I promised Ed I would go test ride one. When you ride, do you get the same experience of riding a bike that you always did?
Except I have a bigger smile on my face even.
I love it. That's awesome. I love it.
No, it's just like, you know, I'm pedaling, I'm working hard. And then I work a little harder. And the bikes that I ride, they respond to your torque. When you're torquing really hard, they give you more power. If you're not pedaling very hard. They don't give you that much power. So I'll be working hard. And all of a sudden I just put a little more power on. And instead of going up that steep 16% hill at 3 or 4 miles an hour, maybe standing up, I can go up at 11 miles an hour. And that's pretty nice.
That's a huge difference.
And I'm still working hard.
Let me take another moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Estelle Gray. What a fun conversation. And if you do not know about R&E Cycles, you can look them up. Estelle had a career there, then a career as a special ed teacher. And I do want to talk about what you're doing now, because you're doing some really cool stuff. Yeah. But I want to ask you one other question, and that's about Sally. So one of the books that I sold the hell out of in my store was her Heart Zone book. And I did not know you two were married.
Yeah, we've been together over 25 years.
And I have obviously been out to lunch for 25 years. So how is she?
She's great. She's great. Yeah.
And I'm sure she's as crazy as ever busy, because she did a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
Is she still competing?
No.
Oh, good.
although
we're now that Oregon. You say that.
Now you say that, in Oregon, there's 4 triathlons. That's where Sal's love was. There's 4 triathlons in the whole state, and one of them is the state championship. And we looked at it last year, and in our age groups, she's one age group higher than me, there was nobody in them, or one person. So I'm like, oh, we can do a triathlon. We can be the state champions, maybe. All we have to do is finish.
Right, exactly. Cross that line.
Yeah, so we saved one. We each have one non-electric road bike.
You do.
Just in case we want to become the state champion.
Yeah, so that's another interesting question as to whether we're going to see some e-bike kind of competitions coming up as they become more prolific in the marketplace.
What's interesting is, you know, when some people, so a number of my friends were like, you got an e-bike? You? Well, if you got one, maybe I can get one. And when we show up with road bikes, or say we have an e-bike, people are like, oh, that's cheating. And I'm like, well, do you have power steering on your car? Because if so, that's cheating, right?
Great response, sure.
So then, but if we go to a mountain bike ride, people are like, oh, you have an e-bike. That's so cool. I wish I had one. And when we're doing long, steep climbs to get to where we're going, and we're sitting back, chit-chatting and having fun, and everybody else just working their brains out, and we get home and we're not as exhausted. I went on one ride. It was a women's ride, and e-bikes were not allowed. But I just showed up on my e-bike. I didn't care about it. And I rode with the gang. We were about maybe 11 or 12. We had a great time. And when we were done, we stopped for coffee, and I had my bike leaned against the wall. And somebody was looking at it. It was actually the person that organized the ride. And she said, oh, I really like how your bottom bracket's covered there. It's really good looking, that bottom bracket, the way it's covered. And I said, yeah. I said, you know, this company makes really nice bikes. I said, okay. So I went over to her and said, hey, that's not just a cover. That's an e-bike. She's like, you were on an e-bike? And I was like, yeah. Did it matter? And she was like, Because it was a pretty fast ride. I wouldn't have been able to keep up, but it let me keep up. She was like, And now that ride, I can't tell you, is probably half the women are on e-bikes.
Right. And that's what I'm hearing from tour directors too, that they're adding e-bikes to their rentals and they're the ones that go first. I was assisting a ride in Israel in 2019 before COVID, BC, as we say. And same things. The ride attracted so many more women that year because e-bikes were available. And it's really hilly where that ride took place. So, yeah. All right. Let's talk about what you're doing and how you became involved with the conflict in Ukraine. And just tell me about that.
Yeah, so we're fairly new to Medford, and some friends called us maybe 3 or 4 days after the invasion and said, hey, there's a rally going on in Medford tomorrow. Do you want to go with us? And we said, sure. We're not particularly super political, but this to me was humanitarian, not political. So we said, yeah. And then Sal and I were talking, and I said, gosh, it would be nice to have a big Ukraine flag, wouldn't it? And Sal said, yeah, that would be. But where in Medford's not a very big town. Where are we going to find a Ukraine flag around here?
Right.
Said, if we can't buy one, let's make one. I sew. So I ran down to the local sewing store and got yellow and blue fabric and made a flag. And we carried it. And I made little lapel pins. Shame on me not having one on now. And there were maybe 60, 75 people at the rally, and I brought like 30, and I gave to one to two or three people, another one. And next thing I know, I was just inundated with people asking me for a little pin. And then there was a news reporter, and they interviewed me about the flag. And when it was done, she said, "Can I buy one from you?" And I was like, "No, I don't, you know." She goes, "Oh, please, I'll pay you anything, please." And I was like, I don't. And then somebody else overheard the conversation, and they came over. And the next thing you know, I had 10 or a dozen people asking me to make them flags. So on the way home, we said, I wonder if we could turn this into a fundraiser. And part of the reason it was important to us is Sal and myself, by marriage, own a software company, and we, our software engineers are in Ukraine. And we talk to them once a week. Now we talk to them once a day. So we called them and said, "What can we do to help with money?" And they said that the front lines have medical, but all of the medical stuff, they live in Lviv, which by now many people know is next to Poland, 25, 30 miles from Poland. So they said, even Lviv, we've been asked to send, the hospitals had sent as much of their medical stuff to the front lines. We have no medical stuff. And then a little later they said, Europe doesn't even have medical supplies now. They've sent them all. So we found a way that we're purchasing medical supplies here in the US, and they're getting shipped to Poland. And then Poland is getting them to our business friends in Lviv. So we started a website called Ukraine Flags for Solidarity is our name, but the website is ukraineflags.org. And we're selling full-size flags that you can put on a flagpole outside, or the little 12 by 18 flags, or garden flags, and lots of these little lapel pins. And it has inundated us with us. It grew so fast, so out of control. It's we have, right now I have 22, I think, different people sewing flags around the country.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, it's a friend of, I tell somebody, and they go, "Oh, my sister sews."
She's, yeah, my husband's mother sews. I already asked her. She said, "Sure." Exactly.
And that's the way it's just taken off.
Do you have a pattern for the flag? Or yes. Are you just saying, just, you know, sew it?
One of the nice things about the flag is it's just two horizontal or vertical stripes.
Yes.
Very simple. You just, you know, I have a picture, I have a quote, you know, a diagram, and, you know, the four steps to sew it. But anybody that has a sewing machine knows how to sew a seam.
So it's Ukrainian flags.org?
Ukraineflags.org.
Ukraineflags.org. We will definitely put a link up to that on the Outspoken Cyclists website for sure.
And I want to link my sewing to cycling, if I may. So when I was teaching, I told you I rode to work all the time, and I ran an after-school sewing club. And when I proposed it, I can't tell you how many teachers at some point in those times I said, "I can't believe you run the sewing club." And I'm like, "Why do you think, what's the big deal about me?" They're like, "You ride your bike to work." Like, what is my riding my bike have to do with sewing? You know, I ride my bike because I don't like driving a car, and I like the exercise. And yes, sewing is just something else that I do. So it was very funny.
It is funny. I knit, and I'm sure a lot of people would go, "Wait a minute, you knit?" But I also teach yoga. And then they go, "Wait, and you do bike fitting?" And you know, it's like, you just do what you do, right?
Same thing. I knit too. And I'm pigeonholed too, because I'm athletic. They don't take the athlete and sort of domestic stuff and put them together. And I was very lucky. My parents allowed me to be androgynous growing up. I helped in the kitchen all the time. I loved to sit next to my mom and watch her knit, and she taught me. And I love to play outside, and they didn't stop me from doing either.
I think it's awesome. Good parents, good thinking.
I have really great parents.
Yeah.
My mom's 95 years old and still walking 2 miles.
Is she good for her? Good for her. Well, Estelle, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. This has just been delightful. Please say hello to Sal. And I will be in touch about the flags, and we will put all the information up. And where are the flags being sent when they're made?
To whoever on the website, there's an order form. And then I have somebody that just designates. I have some folks selling just the garden flags and some sewing the big ones. So then we coordinate. I'll tell somebody I've got 5 garden flag orders. She'll sew 5 flags. I'll send her the order and then they're postal mailing them. They just fit in little envelopes.
And then the money goes directly into?
It goes into an account that we have. And then every time we get about, we're easily going to raise 10,000 quickly. And that 10,000 will go immediately. And then we'll start on another 10,000. We're more than halfway there. And it's only 2.5 weeks old.
It's awesome. Well, let's see if we can't get it to 20, like right away. All
right. Well, I thank you very much.
Thank you. And have a great afternoon.
Oh, I will. It's beautiful.
Don't talk to me about the weather, though.
Okay.
Take care, Estelle. Thank you.
My pleasure.
All right.
Bye-bye. Estelle Gray joined me from her home in Medford, Oregon. If you are interested in purchasing one of her Ukraine flags or pins, if you want to donate to the cause through her efforts, or maybe you want to help sew, you can log on to ukraineflags.org. Let's take a short break, and when we return, we'll head to New York City to speak with journalist John Sirico. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. I'm always happy when I speak with John Sirico. Today, we're going to catch up with a variety of topics, including his upcoming work with the Central Park Conservancy, the explosion of e-bikes in New York, and a lot of answers to some of my now-what questions post-pandemic.
Hi, John. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me. How have you been?
I've been good. I've been busy. Lots to cover. Lots going on.
Yes, I know. I've been following, as I always do, and it's always good to catch up. So first, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
All right. Let's talk about why I'm congratulating you. Central Park Conservancy. What is it? What's your role there? And everybody loves Central Park, for heaven's sake.
Yeah. So the Conservancy was started in the 80s and was largely responsible for transforming the park into what it is today. So it's a nonprofit that kind of, you know, largely takes care of the park and helps fund it. So they started this Institute for Urban Parks about 10 years ago. And really the mission of that institute is to more equitably kind of spread out their resources. They have so many resources and best practices. It's the most visited urban park in the world. I mean, it is, you know, it sees more visitors each year than Disney World, which is my favorite fact. And they have they just have so much institutional knowledge to kind of to share with the country and the city. So I will be helping them with that kind of work, you know, aiding other park groups and kind of getting their advocacy campaigns and things like that situated, but also deepening their research really on starting to think about open space as a larger term, parks not just being kind of siloed to parks, and thinking more about what did we learn from COVID about open space. And I think this starts to veer more a lot into the open space street conversation, public plazas, public space. You know, I think during COVID, we learned that all open space is really important, not just green space, right? So I'm going to be helping a lot with that work, which I'm really, really excited about.
Yeah, it sounds like a really fun part of your work. It certainly juxtaposes perfectly with everything else you do.
Thank you.
And let's mention or expand a little bit on open space.
Yeah.
During COVID, people were able to ride in the streets, walk in the streets, do things, you know, set up sidewalk parks and sidewalk places to eat. How has that changed since sort of COVID has been waning now?
So now we're in the phase of, first off, what does this look like now that it's become permanent, right? And what does the permanent policy look like? I mean, this is a conversation that cities all over the place are having, but seeing it kind of firsthand in New York, especially with the outdoor dining conversation, you know, New York allowed restaurants to just expand into parking spaces out front. And now we start to talk about, all right, the emergency order is going to be lifted. And what do we do with all these outdoor dining structures now? How do we make this into a flexible system? And we started to see this with all sorts of different initiatives, whether it was streets that were calmed for traffic, you know, streets that were closed to traffic entirely, the parklets that you mentioned. It's a lot of this like nuts and bones and bolts of planning that needs to happen, right? Because we were kind of in this emergency phase where this was allowed to happen, right? And there was, not to say little community engagement, but it happened faster than most planning things happen, right? So it happened at a kind of breakneck speed. And I think that's going to become a much larger battle once you start to make this into permanent policy, because you have to go through the kind of, you know, I think what planners really, really dislike, which is this phase of going to the community boards, going, having to face the angry residents, having to kind of go through the zoning regulations. And I think the cities that step up and do it, that are, they're going to embrace this and hopefully keep some of these programs around, it will basically, we'll go back to that pre-pandemic way of planning, which was just much more prolonged, right? And I think we're in a COVID speed where like we just, space was reclaimed like with overnight, which was both exhilarating, but also I think when we start to think about a permanent program, it can be, it's going to be a much longer project.
I look at what happened with traffic.
Yeah.
And speed and a lot of crashes and a lot of things going on. And I'm wondering if there are cities, especially New York, that are looking at closing down permanently certain things. I think about, I think it might be Denver or maybe Boulder that has some of these sort of facilities where you can get around with a car, but in the middle, it's all walkable, bikeable space. And there are stores and there are restaurants and everything else. And I'm wondering how cities are really looking at that as being not only important, but necessary to getting people who don't want to have a car, who want to ride a bike, to live and work in those areas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and also you start to see that, you know, that was starting to happen before COVID, where these kind of new urbanites were moving in and you know, showing up in surveys and saying, we want walkable neighborhoods, we want things, you know, the 15-minute city was a conversation that was happening for some time before it kind of became this kind of pandemic, you know, phenomenon in a lot of ways. But I think that with some of these initiatives, you know, seeing it in New York with the open streets and the open restaurants, if you kind of view it no longer as a pandemic era and experiment and really see it as what I like to call it, it's like an iterative design. Like if it's basically starting to see like experimental designs and you're using, it was because of the pandemic, it was pandemic response, but now it's starting to shift to a phase where maybe we can start to design the street differently that we close to traffic. Maybe this was really popular and we should think about that. What else can we add there? And you start to move away. And certainly this has happened kind of firsthand. I've seen with a lot of cities that you'll go on the website of the new initiative and the pandemic kind of phrasing is kind of leaving. It's more now like recovery, economic development, walking, cycling. So it's trying to change the language that this is like how we're going to respond to the next couple of years of recovery, I think is going to be really important to watch.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with one of my really good friends, John Sirico. I really like talking to him. He's just one of these modern, forward-thinking, I don't say just urban planners. You're a scholar, you're a journalist, you do so many different things, and people want to hear from you. I hear from my listeners all the time, when's John coming back on the show? Well, he's back on the show today. So I want to talk a little bit about the infrastructure bill.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know if I mentioned this to you or not. So a couple of weeks ago, I talked with Tab Combs down in Carolina, and she mentioned or said, the money's there. There is money for this stuff. It's that will to get these things done. You know, it's that impetus to push to get the money out of the bank and into a project. So tell me about the infrastructure bill and how that may or may not be sort of pushing any of these things.
I think that's a great point because I think on paper, it's going to flood these programs with so much more funding, right? All these great programs that the federal DOT had, like transportation alternatives is one of them, the TAP program, which, you know, floods money to bikeways and greenways, which has led to, you know, the East Coast Greenway, a lot of these programs that we know and that are popular. But a lot of it falls on state DOTs who mostly just build highways, right, and build roads. And I think a very telling exchange was when the federal DOT said to local state DOTs, saying to them, listen, you can't just use this infrastructure bill to build new highways. You can only use it to renovate, or you should try to use it just to renovate, not expand. And that caused a kind of firestorm amongst a lot of the Republican state DOTs saying, like, how dare you tell us how to spend the money? But I think it's a very telling exchange where these are like, you know, systems that for the past 70 years have mostly been using federal funds to build roads. And we really don't want that infrastructure again. We kind of want to move to this, you know, obviously more people walking, cycling, and using public transit, but also electrifying the fleet, all these other things. And I think at the end of the day, the implementation, the devil's going to really be in the details, because there's a lot of flashy things on paper. But if you have a state DOT that's not really ambitious, or have a city that's not really ambitious, the money could easily be spent on expanding that highway, adding, you know, Hyperloop, adding, you know, things that are kind of like, I think transit advocates stay up at night worrying about.
Yeah. So it's, I know fixing the bridges are really important. That's a good
thing. For sure.
You know, you watched what happened to President Biden when he got to Pittsburgh.
Without a doubt.
That bridge collapse. It's like, well, there's a reason we need the infrastructure bill.
Yeah.
But when I look at, for example, in Cleveland, and we were just having this conversation last night, how frustrating it is that here's a little piece of path, here's a little piece of path, here's a little piece of path, nothing connects them. And those are the kinds of things that I think people want to see. If you have a highway system that you can get from A to B, why not have an off-road or path or some sort of biking, walking system?
Yeah. And I mean, I'm encouraged that you're having all these kind of new mayors come to town that are, you know, interested. I think Michelle Wu being the best example in Boston, someone who is like a transit rider. She's using a lot of the federal funds to make bus routes free in low-income communities. And it's exciting. And I think you're going to have that kind of local energy to push back against these state DOTs and say, you know, we're going to use the money for something quite innovative. And I think that's something that, because the federal program hasn't had a lot of, these DOT programs haven't had a lot of money, they've kind of disjointed the way all this planning works, because it's sometimes it's local, sometimes it's state, sometimes it's federal. And I'm going to be really looking at how these kind of local city players really kind of act here, because it's a lot of the money is going to fall in their laps as well. And they're going to have to really make the case to their states that, hey, we need to use it for this specific new bus route or BRT. We don't want to use it for this kind of highway that needs to be expanded or whatever it might be.
Yeah, and they might go through a neighborhood.
Yeah.
Worse yet, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to shift gears a little bit, and I want to talk about e-bikes. You've been doing a lot of shows about e-bikes because they just seem to be exploding in terms of the bike industry. And I think we have a population that is starting to really ride them.
Yeah.
So what about e-bikes? Are you having any issues in New York, and or what are you seeing about e-bikes on paths and trails and just all over for transportation, for recreation?
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I'm starting to report a story out about e-bikes right now. So I won't mention everything specifically, but the main thing is cities keeping up. This is a growth that's quite explosive. And I think we haven't seen anything really like it maybe since like the advent of the automobile. I don't really even know what the comparison would be, because it's spiking really fast. The projections keep getting surpassed. These numbers are just unbelievable. I was just reading about these bike shops, and I think now with the gas prices, we're seeing even more, right? Like it's like both the pandemic and 1970s thing combined, which is fascinating. And I think I've been reading all these articles about bike shops are now thinking this spring and summer is going to even surpass the pandemic records they hit. It's really cities keeping up. I mean, like this is going to be explosive growth. You have to meet it with fast road redesigns. You have to meet it with, actually having infrastructure, making those bikes more affordable through credits. This is something that was supposed to be in the federal bill, but obviously that bill, the big Build Back Better Act, still wallowing away in Congress. We'll see what kind of happens, but states and local municipalities filling that gap and e-bike incentives. A lot of the states, they're still somewhat illegal and in kind of a gray space, so it's figuring that out. And then obviously, you know, the safety issue, because you have these vehicles that are going quite fast, figuring out the safety issue, because that could affect the pedestrian environment, right? So there's a lot of things there. And then, you know, we're seeing this crazy growth in the city bike electric bikes here. It's their most popular product by far. When I did the story for the New York Times in December, the statistics are just unbelievable how much they're being used. But they're still contractually limited a lot of ways. They need to keep building docks. They need to, you know, they're only allowed to have a certain amount. So there's a lot of like technicalities that need to change. In state laws and local laws that I think are hindering the growth. And then also, then you just have the real world, the fact we just don't have enough bike lanes, right? And there needs to be more bike lanes to kind of handle this.
We also have in the industry, even though it is an explosive part of the industry, we do have a part shortage. So, mm-hmm. You know, exactly. They're selling as many bikes as they can get. And then you have the issue of now, where do we ride them? So yeah, it's just a really interesting time in our industry. It's something I haven't seen since the 10 speed was the big deal back in the day.
How about
public transport? What's going on in New York City? We always look to New York to know what's going to happen 10 years from now.
I feel like if you ask New Yorkers that, they would say, but we're so behind on so many other things. Public transit, I've just been like, this is a big conversation, just watching the subway and bus numbers every week, seeing where they are compared to where they were. We have not gone past the 60% number. We have hit a ceiling and we're not passing it. 60% pre-pandemic ridership.
Why?
My guess is that the other 40% are just the office jobs that aren't going back full time. That's my guess, because I mean, just anecdotally, I don't know any close friend of mine that has returned to the same schedule or is taking the subway or bus as much as they were pre-pandemic. Just they're not at all. So I'm guessing that's the majority of it. You might have a fraction who's still quite scared because of COVID, which I totally, that's something that it's hard to judge how much that it is, because it's kind of hard to study. And then there is a somewhat notable spike in subway crime that's happened that I think is overblown in some respects by some publications, but it is statistically, it has happened. And you can argue whether that's linked to less eyes on the street, less people using the system, right? There's a lot of different causes of it. And obviously there was a mental health crisis with COVID that was happening before COVID. So there's a lot of different reasons where that 40% could be. But I think at the end of the day, there's just not the millions of trips to be had anymore. And I think public transit, this is like, to me, the biggest issue for public transit agencies. How do you live with that? And also, how do you attract new riders, right? How do you attract that other 40% and even surpass it, go past your old numbers? It's going to be a very difficult challenge.
How does housing fit into the public transit and even the biking, walking? Housing is just crazy right now.
Yeah. And then I'm glad you brought it up, because it's not talked about enough with this situation where transit-oriented development, right? Building around these stations. There's so many commuter rail stations that just have parking lots around them and no one lives near them. And they, as a result, just don't attract as many riders. You're not best utilizing the land. And it's something that could, one, really attract more riders. It could help solve the housing crisis, right? We know all that. But you face a lot of like the local planning issues I mentioned before, where California, I think, is the best case study for this, but California's been dealing with this forever. But New York, the governor put forward a transit-oriented development bill, which would have changed the zoning around stations. And then all the local lawmakers thought it was the end of the suburbs, and she quickly withdrew the bill. So you have a lot of these realities that keep unfolding, where we know it's a viable, it would hit many birds with one stone, to use the allegory, but there's still a lot of those local planning realities that are tough to face. But thankfully, I think we're talking about it way more than we used to.
Yeah, housing is, I see housing prices, I see gas prices, and you're wondering what makes you think you want to live way out in the suburbs when you work,
totally.
Unless you aren't going to work, which of course, the whole system seems to be blowing up.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about trends. What do you see trending besides e-bikes for cyclists, for walkers, for infrastructure in general? Do you see something different from what's happened in the past?
Right now, I would say a lot of the kind of trends I've been noticing and kind of focusing on is just this fight over curb space. I mean, it seems like it's gotten so out of control, and to borrow a colleague of mine's description, he said it's been very binary for so long. It's either, it's going to be a parking spot, or it was going to be like an outdoor dining, or it's going to be, just that. Like, we got an outdoor dining during COVID and that was the second choice, but forever it was just the parking spot. But then there's all these other things that we need now, right? Increasingly, it seems like we need spots for trucks, for online deliveries. We need e-bike chargers. We need docks. We need bike racks. We need all these things. And it just seems like the curb space is just being squeezed, because we know we have all these huge infrastructure challenges. We know we need to address them. We know curb space is valuable. And I think it's just going to get, I think it's getting worse and worse. I mean, the online deliveries, I feel like they've taken over cities. And they need space, right? They need a lot of space, because they're clogging up roads, they're causing pollution. But it seems like this pandemic era habit isn't going anywhere and perhaps is getting even more and more intense.
I was just going to ask if you were seeing any cities like London, like Paris, that are either taxing, if you want to use that word, it is a tax of a sort. Somebody who wants to actually drive into the city as opposed to parking on the exterior and then getting in and keeping that traffic to a minimum.
Yeah. So I would say, my experience being back in London, right, knowing that city really well, recently went back there to graduate from my program 2 years late. But
you did it. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It was great going back and seeing so much of the work they've done and so many pandemic era things that they're making permanent. Most famously, their cycle. They did so many pop-up cycle lanes in London and these low traffic neighborhoods, which curb people, you know, using residential neighborhoods as shortcuts, which is a big problem in the UK. But one thing that's really interesting is they have this new ultra low emission zone. For a long time, it covered just the center of the city. So if you have an old car, this old polluting car, the threshold is like 2013 or before that, you get charged if you entered the center of London. So this is on top of the congestion charge, which they've had since 2000. You also would get charged if you have a really old polluting car because air quality there is terrible. They have a really bad air quality problem. But now they're expanding it. So now it's covering even more of the city. And eventually next year, it's going to cover the entire city. So if you have an old polluting car, you're going to get charged wherever you are. And this was largely in response to fund public transit because they lost a lot of money during COVID. They knew they need a new revenue source. I think they're also dealing with the fact that 40%, I think they're up to like 70% pre-pandemic, but that ridership might not ever come back. So how do we figure out these new revenue sources? How can we kind of also address other problems we have, in their case, air quality, carbon emissions? So they've really taken the lead, London, with charging and really charging drivers and making this if you have an older car that pollutes the city, you will have to pay for that because you're causing air pollution. And it's really interesting because it's taken on different reasons why they need it. Now it's really to fund the public transit ridership loss. So I look to London a lot for that kind of, it's crazy, it's a huge move and seeing it politically feasible in New York and in the US, New York's going to start with the congestion charge next year. We'll see. It's going to be really interesting to see cities here take that on because it's a risk for sure.
How do they do that? So you have a 1999 Buick.
Yeah.
How they know where you are and are charging you?
So to have a car in London, you have to have like a unified toll. So you have this kind of thing on your car. They are the most surveilled city in the world. So London has CCTV everywhere. There's cameras everywhere. That largely is left over from the congestion charge, but also protecting their bike, their bus lanes. They're going to start using cameras for their bike lanes too, which is quite unique. So they just have a huge camera and the amount of surveillance that they have that can just hit cars. But also it's tagged to your license and your tolls. So you're basically being monitored the minute you enter a specific zone and that tags your licenses, which we see this with speed cameras, right? This technology isn't anything particularly new, but it's just being deployed in a much more expansive way there.
What's the citizen pushback?
When congestion charging was first brought in 2000, it was really unpopular until it was implemented. So we see that here in New York where it's there's a rising tide of unpopularity. It's probably why the governor is pushing it off till next year because their election year is this year. I think that's why personally. But then it gets implemented. The cities get much less congested. We saw this in Stockholm and Singapore as well. And then popularity raises because people get used to it. Like any other initiative, right? People adapt and they get used to it. But with the ULEZ zone, it has a lot of pushback, especially from some of the taxi drivers. The taxi industry there is quite powerful, but they also have a really bad air quality problem. And it's quite known. I mean, it's called the big smoke, the great smog. I mean, it's known for being having some serious air quality issues. So I think there's a very evident kind of link the mayor has made there that I think makes a lot of sense to people. So he's gotten popular support. It's gotten received well, but it's unpopular. When anytime they want to expand, there's always a lot of outbursts and anger, and then it kind of gets adopted over time.
It's interesting. I think back to when the City of London first put in their bike share program, and they were called Boris Bikes.
Yeah.
And now, of course, we have a prime minister with seems to be like the same guy, right?
Yeah.
That's Boris. Yeah. So what are you working on right now that is a little bit different and new that you can talk about?
Sure. So I am working on a story about New York's kind of fight to get its bus service back up and running. The bus system also saw a big drop in ridership, just like the subways. They're hovering around 60%, and they had all these plans before COVID, because bus ridership has been on the decline for a long time in New York. I think we have this pandemic memory, and we forget that before COVID, there's these other trends that were going in this direction. The ridership was going down for quite some time. They had all these plans. COVID put them on hold, and now they're back. So I'm doing a story about where they land. And then other than that, focusing on something about e-bikes in New York in the spring and summer, because I think we're about to see a really wild spring and summer with e-bike use. I think it's going to be record highs. I mean, unbelievable usage in cities everywhere, just because they're starting to hit like a mainstream. Like, I feel like I hear from so many people that are using them all the time, way more than other forms of transit. So I'm looking forward to watching that. And then seeing kind of how the infrastructure dollars are going to start pouring into cities. That's, I would say, my main focus right now. And then I also leave time to teach students as well. So I teach journalism. So a lot going on as the semester kind of winds down, but it's tons to report on, which is great.
Well, as always, I love talking with you because you have your finger in every one of these pies that I'm interested in. I really like that. Tell my listeners how they can follow you too. You work with Bloomberg, you have your own site, and you appear in a lot of places.
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much, Dan. So you could follow me on Twitter at John Sirico. I also have my newsletter, Street Beat, which I write every month. That kind of gives you an overview of what I'm looking at, what I'm writing about, all related to streets and cities. That's Street Beat on Substack. And I would say also my website, johnsirico.com. Those are the best ways, I would say.
Well, I really enjoy, as I said, I really enjoy talking with you because, first of all, it always gives me hope.
I don't know what about that. No, what about me gives off hope? But
well, that you see a lot of positive possibilities. Mm. You know, there are a lot of doomsayers out there, and,
for sure.
And certainly in my business, in the bicycle business, it's been a dismal couple of. I mean, everybody's doing well when they can but there's sort of a lingering. Well, you know, it's the bike business, you know, and I think there's some excitement out there that they could get behind, and you've got it. So I really enjoy that. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Diane. I so appreciate coming on. I always love it.
Take care.
All right, I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
My thanks to John Sirico for joining me again this week. John is always a fun and informative guest. You can follow his work on Bloomberg's City Lab, as well as on his own website, johnsirico.com. I've added some links to other things he's up to on our website, outspokencyclist.com. My thanks once again to Estelle Gray, and remember that you can help support efforts to send medical assistance to Ukraine via Estelle and Sal's ukraineflags.org website. Next time on The Outspoken Cyclist, I'm speaking with Rock Lobster's Paul Sadoff. He begged off of Sea Otter for the first time in many years, but did attend Guest House, a one-day show in Santa Cruz featuring some big names in the bike world. We talk about that and a whole lot more. I hope you'll join me then. Quick update on Dimitri and his family. Dimitri's wife, children, mom, mother-in-law, and the family dog all arrived safely in Israel last week. Now he's able to focus on getting his company, Triton Bikes, back up and running. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this week's show. Go to OutspokenCyclist.com for photos, show notes, and links. Please stay safe, stay well, and remember, there's always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.